Can you start? Yeah. So we'll continue our discussion on security, which we started last time. So last time I gave a quick overview of encryption algorithm. Okay, so we are going to take that background and build on it. So we'll look at authentication. We'll look at several users, as well, key exchange authentication and several applications such as secure email, okay, and firewalls and so on. So let's start with authentication. Okay, so this is, remember, this is a problem of proving to someone that you are who you claim to be. Okay, so here is an example of somebody calls up on the phone and says, claim to be your bank, and they want some secret information, let's say your ATM card. Okay, so how do you know that the person who's calling you is actually from the bank, but not somebody who's fraudulently claiming to? Okay, so in other words, in this case, the person who called you has to authenticate to you that they are your bank, okay, for you to provide this information to them. Okay, so this is the problem of authentication. Now, this, of course, arises in a number of contexts. When you try to log on to a system, you are authenticating yourself to the system so that the system can let you in and you have certain rights and privileges on that system. Okay. So let's look at several variants of this algorithm. Okay, so here, the first one, which is version one of your authentication protocol. So Alice just tells Bob, I'm Alice. Okay, so this was the same problem we looked at on the previous slide, where someone of the bank or someone calls you and claims to be your bank, but is not providing any information to you. Okay, so clearly, an intruder can also send the same message, and there is no reason to believe one way or another that the person is who they claim to be. Okay. And the same thing can happen even if you use IP addresses. Okay, so suppose this is a machine that's trying to prove to some other entity, a person or another machine, that you are this machine. Okay, just providing an IP address doesn't help, because IP addresses are also prone to spoofing. Okay, you could, if you actually had root access, you could change the protocol stack and insert any IP address you want on the packet header. Okay, so just because you get a packet from a certain IP address doesn't mean it originated there, because it's vulnerable to spoofing. Okay. So the basic technique that is used in authentication is to use a password. Okay, so that should be clear. So the trivial protocol like Telnet sends password in clear text. Okay, so here Alice is sending a message to Bob saying, I'm Alice, here is my password. Okay, and since the password is a secret known only to Alice, If the person provides the correct password, you believe that they are who they claim to be. Okay? So the problem of sending the password in clear text is obviously it can be intercepted by an intruder, and then your secret gets stolen, and that intruder can also then masquerade as you. Okay? So now that's the reason protocol like Telnet are insecure and you need better variants. Okay? That naturally leads to use of encryption during authentication. Okay, so we looked at several encryption protocols last time. This one is going to use a symmetric key protocol, like the ones we studied last time. So this is the message exchange. So you basically, in the symmetric key protocol, you assume that Alice and Bob have figured out a secret key. Okay, this is a symmetric key and this is only known to Alice and Bob. Okay, so Alice can send a message to Bob saying, I am Alice, and it's encrypted with that secret key. Okay. Now, Bob can certainly decrypt that message, because Bob also knows the secret key, and extract its content, which says, I'm Alice. Okay. Now, since Bob knows that only Alice has the secret key other than Bob, this message could have only originated from Alice. Okay. So this is a very simple way of authenticating using symmetric key. Okay. Now, the problem with this approach, okay, even if you use very good symmetric key algorithms, okay, is that it is vulnerable to what are called playback attacks or replay attacks. Okay. So in other words, an intruder can actually intercept this message, okay, which is an encrypted version of the message, I'm Alice, and at some later point in time send the same message back to Bob. Okay. At this point, Bob will assume that, because if you run this algorithm or check, Bob will assume that the message originated from Alice. No way to know when the message was sent just by looking at its content. So in replay attacks, you can replay the same message and get access to the system. Okay. So there has to be a way to use encryption, but also ensure that you cannot use replay attacks, okay, during authentication. So that brings us to version 4 of the algorithm. Okay, and this, what is done here is you use not one. So the problem in the previous case was also that the encryption key is a one-time password, essentially. So you can replay that password and then you get into trouble. So here we are going to use a sequence of quote-unquote passwords. They're not real passwords, but they're a sequence of messages that are never used again. Okay, so in other words, what we will use is this notion of a nonce. A nonce is basically an integer, which is a once-in-a-lifetime integer, meaning that if you pick this value over the lifetime of this application, you will never pick that value again. Okay, so you pick this value from a very large set, so that if you pick one at random, there is good probability that you will never pick it again. Okay, so the way the algorithm works is the nonce is as follows. So Alice sends a message to Bob saying, "I'm Alice." This is unencrypted. This just goes through in clear text. And Bob, at this point, generates a once-in-a-lifetime nonce. Okay, this is an integer. Okay, and it's assumed that any time in the past when you have gotten any message, okay, or any time in the future you get some message, you will never pick this nonce again. Okay, so assume that it's once-in-a-lifetime. And it's the value is n. So you send this back to Alice. Okay, now what Alice does is she encrypts the nonce with the symmetric key, rather than the previous case, you encrypted a string saying I am Alice. Okay. So here you encrypted the nonce and you send it back to Bob. Okay, now Bob can decrypt it and see that you got the nonce back. Okay, so this tells you that this encryption has happened only for this session because you only generated this nonce right now. Second, since you used the secret key and only Alice knew this key, this message could have only come from Alice. Yes, so you authenticated Alice, but eliminated the replay attack from the previous scenario. Okay, is this clear? So this notion of a nonce is also referred to as a challenge, okay, in many scenarios. So you basically issue a challenge, and here is a challenge. In this case, it's an integer. Okay, but there are other variants of this protocol where that require specific responses for specific challenges. This is just the authentication protocol. Okay, so you are just trying to authenticate that you are Alice. So when Alice tells Bob saying, "I want to authenticate myself," Bob is going to send a challenge back. Okay, in this case, it's just an integer. And the assumption is that any subsequent attempts to authenticate will never regenerate this integer. Okay? Now, this is actually used in for login authentication. So there are variants of SSH that actually uses. So you basically tell the machine that you want to log in. Machine generates an integer and sends it back, a nonce and sends it back. And what you do is you encrypt it with your key and send it back to the machine. That's the response you generated to the challenge. Okay? And then the machine verifies that your response is correct to the challenge. So the challenge was encrypt this integer and you send this response back. Okay? And then you decrypt it and verify that you actually send back an encrypted version of the challenge. Okay, so
Receive these two messages again.
Yeah. So question is, attacker can receive this message and send it again. Since the assumption is this is once in a lifetime, this is never going to be generated again, the attacker cannot log into the system subsequently by replaying this message. Because next time anyone tries to log in or claim that they are someone, you will generate a different nonce. Okay, so an encrypted version of the nonce doesn't help you at all. Because in that case, the response would be the encrypted version of the new nonce, not the old one. Okay, yes, question.
Is the encryption over here done with the B's public key or is it done with the A's?
How is the encryption done? This is using symmetric keys, not public and private key. I'll show a variant with public and private keys. So in symmetric keys, both parties have to agree on the key beforehand.
Okay. So
that has been done before. That's the part about key distribution we talked about. In symmetric keys, we will generate these keys and figure what, and we'll talk about key distribution again. Okay. So here is the same algorithm using public and private keys. Okay. So now what happens is Alice sends a message to Bob saying, "I'm Alice." Okay, assume that Alice is a user, Bob is a machine. Okay, Alice wants to log into this machine. So Bob or the machine sends back a once in a lifetime nonce. Okay, just from the game. So now what Alice does is Alice uses Alice uses her private key to sign this message and send it back. Okay. Then Bob can use the public key to verify that Alice is the only one who could have signed this key with because the private key is only known to Alice. Okay, so since it's once in a lifetime integer, only Alice could have sent this message and it's the correct nonce. Okay, so this is how you will go about. Yes, you have a question here.
So in the previous slide, again, it seems to be a chicken and egg problem. I mean, in symmetrically, you first authenticate that you're exchanging the key with the right person, and you also are using the same.
So how to get the key, we'll talk about in just, that's a separate problem. There are two orthogonal problems. How do you?
Intertwined because, I mean, you need to make sure that you're exchanging the key with the right person.
So aren't there two intertwined? So key distribution is always assumed to be independent of encryption and authentication. We'll look at the key distribution problem separately in the next few slides. So assume that key distribution has happened and you've gotten a secure key. Okay, then how do you go about doing it is this problem. Okay, so now it's a valid problem. How did you get this key? Okay, then the same problem is true even for public and private keys. Okay, because this is also vulnerable to man-in-the-middle attacks. Because if you don't get the right public key, yeah, this protocol can be broken, because in this case the machine has to use Alice's public key to verify that the nonce came back. Okay. If you can supply bogus public keys to the machine, then Trudy can actually send this message signed with her private key, not Alice's private key, and send her public key to the machine. Okay. If the machine believes now this is Alice's key as opposed to Trudy's key, the machine will let Trudy log on as Alice. So this is the man in the middle attack that I showed last time. Okay, so this is the same problem which I just mentioned, saying Trudy can impersonate Alice as Bob. Okay, that's the exact same thing I mentioned. So Trudy sends a message to Bob saying I'm Alice. Okay, Trudy is impersonating Alice. So Bob basically tries to send a nonce back to Alice, which Trudy intercepts. Okay, and then Trudy sends a message signed with her private key, not Alice's private key. Okay. And now Bob has to first get the public key to figure out that whether this is the correct response to the challenge. And here Trudy can intercept the request for the public key and send the wrong key. Okay, this is exactly what we just mentioned. Okay. In other words, the problem of authentication, okay, regardless of what algorithm you use, is only going to be as secure as your key distribution system. If your key distribution is broken, then authentication is also going to be broken. Okay. And this is the same thing is true for symmetric keys as well. If you are not able to agree on the symmetric key in a secure way, your authentication is going to break. Okay. This is the same problem of you may choose a very good password. Okay. Now if you put it on a post-it note and stick it somewhere where someone else can get access to it, your secure password is of no use. Somebody else can use it. Okay. Same thing is true here. You're using a good algorithm, but if you are not able to distribute the key in a secure way, things are broken. Okay, any questions here? Okay. So we'll come to key distribution. Okay, that's an important problem. But before that, I want to talk about some other stuff first, which is digital signatures. Okay. So we looked at the problem of authentication. So authentication is trying to prove to someone else that you are who you claim to be. Okay, and this we looked at authentication protocols to do this. The next problem we are going to look at is digital signatures. Okay, so digital signatures are similar to physical signature. Okay, so if you sign a piece of paper, okay, what does this tell someone else? Okay, it tells them that you signed it. If your signature is not vulnerable to be used by someone, so it shows someone that you signed the paper. And you cannot claim that you did not sign it. If you basically sign a check and send it to the bank, okay, and if bank verifies that this is your signature and pays the check, you cannot go to the bank later and say, I never signed this check, because they'll show you signed it. We have your signature as proof that you signed it. Okay? Same is true in digital signatures. Once you sign a document or let's say a file with your digital signature, you cannot claim later saying, I did not do that. Okay, because the property of digital signature allows someone to verify that you signed it and only you signed it. Okay, and the second property is that no one else can sign as you. Okay, so your signature should guarantee that some other person cannot sign and claim that you signed it. Okay, so if you have these two properties, you have equivalent of your signatures in the digital world. Okay, now question is, how do you go about doing this? Okay, so suppose that A wants to send a message to B and sign it. Okay, and you want these properties. So B can verify that you signed it. That's what a signature does. It allows you to verify that someone signed it. And then if B has this your signed message, A cannot later claim that you never signed it. Okay, because you have a signature that you can present and say you did. So the simple way to do this is to use your public key, or rather your private key. Okay? So if you want to sign a message, you just take the message, you encrypt it with your private key and you send that to Alice. In this case, Bob can send that to Alice. Okay. Now, what does this allow Bob to verify? Okay. Since the public key is known, you can decrypt that message, and that allows you to verify that you encrypted it or signed it with your private key. Okay, that's this step. Okay, this is the encryption key, that's the decryption key. The decryption key is same as the private key, the encryption key is same as the public key. So you can use the public key and verify that you signed it. You can also, Alice cannot claim that she did not sign it, because if only she has the private key, then this shows that she could only she could have signed it, no one else. Okay? So in other words, using your private key and encrypting a document is equivalent to signing that document, okay? or putting a digital signature on that document. Any questions here? Is this clear? And now, all this said, this technique is not really used in practice as is, okay, because this technique is there's a problem with this technique. Does anyone have any thoughts on what the problem might be? Yes. Right. Okay. So this is a scenario being mentioned. You sign a document with your private key, you send it to someone. Okay. Since your public key is known to the whole world, anyone can intercept this message, decrypt it, get the original message, and re-sign it as themselves.
But isn't the message already being sent in clear text for it to know what the original message is?
Yes.
So they don't even need to know that.
Right. So the point with digital signatures is not to encrypt the message. Okay, in this case, you only want to sign the message. Doesn't mean that you want to ensure secrecy of the message. Secrecy and signatures are two independent dimensions. Okay, in secrecy, you don't want someone else to know what the message is. Here, all you're saying is, I have signed this piece of paper. Okay, it doesn't mean what I've signed is secret. It's like a check. I sign a check. Doesn't mean the check is secret. It just allows someone to verify I signed it. It doesn't allow me to claim I did not sign it. Okay? So the scenario you said is absolutely true. One could do that, but that's not the point of digital signature. If you wanted to ensure secrecy of the message, then this protocol will have that problem. Okay? But that we are not trying to guarantee secrecy. What we are trying to guarantee is that you signed the message.
This has the same replay attack.
Yes, but digital signatures don't care about replay attacks. What do you care?
Because you could fake that somebody could fake that you have sent it, but you have not sent it.
So this is not transmission problem, right? Just once I sign the piece of paper, I need to basically, anyone else can prove to me that I signed it, and I cannot claim I did not sign it. This is all that we are trying to guarantee. We are not trying to guarantee secure transit of my signed message. That's a different problem. Yeah, they are all valid problems, secrecy, transit, and so on. And we'll see secure email that will guarantee all of this. They're just building pieces to get to how to do email securely. Okay. Now, the main problem with this protocol is that it is computationally inefficient. Okay, because I showed some examples of public and private keys in last class. You remember that these keys were 2048 bits. Okay, and this message can be of arbitrary size. We have not put any limit on the size of this message. So this could be your 200-page PhD thesis as an example. Okay, that's a long document. If you have to encrypt that with a 248-bit key, it may take hours for that machine to actually compute an encrypted version of it. Since this message can be of arbitrary size and public and private key cryptography is computationally expensive to perform, this is not used in practice. Okay, instead, there is a variant of this used, which is you basically compute what's called a digest and just sign that digest. Okay? So the point to take home is, although this protocol that I just mentioned does allow, give you the property of digital signatures, in practice, you don't use it because the messages can be of arbitrary size. It puts an undue burden on verifying that you signed the message. Okay? So instead, what you want to do is to compute a hash of the message. Okay? And only sign the hash. So that's what is done with what is called message digest. So you have a hash. It takes an arbitrary length string and it hashes it to a fixed length hash. Okay? So you can take any string, and then you can get, let's say, 64-byte hash of that string. And then what you do is you digitally sign the hash, okay, using your private key. Same technique. So now what you do is you send a message, and here the message goes in clear text, and you sign the signature, which is the signed hash value. Okay? And this gives you the same property as the previous protocol. Okay? It is possible to verify that you signed the message. Okay? Because what you can do is you can take the message, any recipient can take this message, compute a hash, because the hashing function is assumed to be well known. Okay, so anyone else can compute the hash. And then you can take your public key and decrypt the signature. Okay, and the hash comes out of the signature and you can verify that the two hashes are identical. So this allows you to prove that you signed this message. Okay? Now somebody else may alter this message in transit. And then you can claim that you did not sign that altered message. Because if you take that altered message, that gives you a different hash. And that's not the message you signed. Okay? So if the message, although it's sent in clear text, is altered, you can claim that you never signed that different message. What you signed was the original message because you only signed that hash. Okay? So, you know, so the hashing function has to have a property which says that the chances of collisions, that two arbitrary strings give you the same hash, has to be very small. Without that, you are in trouble, because if I could actually figure out another string that gives you the same hash, I could generate that string and claim that you signed it, because I have a hash here that you have signed. Okay, so your hashing function needs to have this property which says it should be infeasible to find any two messages, X and Y, so that their hashes are equal. Okay, because then I can replace X with Y and claim that you signed Y, because Y also gives you the same hash. So it should not be possible to do this, and it shouldn't be given a digest text, you shouldn't be able to find another message. Okay, so the collision, probability of collision should be small. Okay, probability of collisions cannot be zero, this should be clear. Okay, because it is a hashing function, you're taking an arbitrary bit string and you're computing a smaller hash. Okay, the number of unique hashes is going to be smaller than the number of strings. Okay, so there will be collision, that should be clear. Okay, but the probability should be small. Is this clear? Okay. So there are many hashing functions that are used in order to do this. So I'm going to talk about, not talk, but just show you a picture of one that's called MD5. Okay, MD stands for message digest. So what this does is it takes an arbitrary size string, as I said, and gives you a fixed size string. So, and the way it does it is, basically takes a constant, and it takes that constant, it takes a bit string, and it computes a digest, and it does that for, so you take a large message, you chop it up into smaller messages, you take, compute digest for each of them, and then you compute what's equivalent to an XOR that gives you the message digest for the whole message. Okay, that's the basic idea. Now we'll not go into the details of how to compute MD5 and so on. I just want you to know that there are good hashing algorithms that are used in practice. Now it turns out that although this algorithm was widely used, there were some scenarios where the previous two properties didn't hold for MD5, okay, meaning that you could find another string that gives, using brute force or other techniques, that generate the same hash. Okay. So if that is the case, then the security of any digital signature is going to be broken, because then you can say that you signed some other document which generates the same hash. As a result, now there are more sophisticated hashing functions used, like SHA hashes and so on. So MD5 is still used, but there are more. If you want to be really secure, you use even better hashing function. Okay, again, we'll not talk about exactly what these hashing functions do. Just keep that in mind. Okay. So we have seen how to do authentication. We have seen how to do digital signatures. And I'm going to now talk about how to do how to do key distribution securely. Okay. Once you do these three, then you have a good way to build higher level applications. And it looks a few like secure email and so on. So let's start with symmetric key exchange. Okay, how do you go about generating the symmetric key? Okay, so how do two distributed entities generate a key? Because now typically this involves a third party. Okay, and the third party is assumed to be trusted by both the entities that want to communicate. Okay, so the basic idea is Alice and Bob want a secure symmetric key for secure communication. Okay, now they have to generate this key and agree on it. So instead of them, they're generating the key, they contact a third entity that they both trust and say, give us a key. Okay, and that's that secure entity give, not secure, rather the trusted entity gives them the key that they'll then use to communicate. Okay, so I think I have a picture here. Okay, so the trusted entity is also referred to as a key distribution center. Okay, this is the entity that's handing out keys. So here is Alice. That's Bob, that's the key distribution center. Now there's one thing I should mention here, that you have to have a prior to doing this, you have to have a key that only you and the key distribution center know. Okay, there has to be a secure way for you to communicate with the key distribution center. Without that, this is broken. Okay, now you could ask, how do you get this key with the key distribution center? Okay, now that is assumed to be done offline. Maybe you go to the key distribution center physically and show your identity and they give you a piece of paper saying this is what you should use, okay, or some such thing. Because you cannot do that using a network, because you'll have the same problem. How do you get that key before you communicate with the key distribution center? So let's assume that you have gotten a key that only you and that key distribution center knows. Okay. So now Alice wants to communicate with Bob. So Alice just sends a message to the KDC saying, I'm Alice, I want to talk to Bob, generate a key for us. Okay. So now the key distribution center is going to generate some key. Okay. So let's call it KAB. This is a key that A and B can use to communicate. So you take that key, and that is now encrypted with the key that only Alice and KDC know. That's KADC. This is the secret key that was only known to Alice and the key distribution center. So generate a session key, okay, the symmetric key, and you encrypt that key itself with Alice, the key that Alice and that KDC know, and you send it back to Alice. Okay. Now in this case, since that key also has to be given to Bob, the KDC is going to do the same thing for Bob. It's going to give the same session key, but now it's encrypted with the secret key that's only known to Bob and the trusted entity. So both Alice and Bob get this encrypted message. They decrypt it and they have a session key, okay, that they can use to communicate. Okay. So small variant of this protocol, same protocol, but small variant where the KDC doesn't send a message to Bob, but instead sends both of these messages to Alice. Okay, this is the session key encrypted with the secret key known to Alice and the KDC. Same session key encrypted with the secret key known to Bob and the KDC. Okay, so then Alice can decrypt this, get the key out, and then send the original message. This part of the message is sent to Bob. The only reason for doing this is in the previous case, Bob is, let's say, a machine. Suddenly a key shows up over the network. You don't know what to do with it. And who are you supposed to communicate with? It's not specified in the key. Case only, you only get a key. So in this case, what happens is, in the second case, Alice has explicitly sent the key to Bob, and you also say, I'm Alice. So you know that this is a key that you're supposed to use to talk to Alice. And the same small detail that you can take care of in this variant. Any questions here? Is this clear? Okay. So here is a variant of the same protocol that uses nonce to prevent replay attacks and so on. This is also referred to as the Needham-Schroeder protocol. Okay. So basically it's the same protocol as the previous case, except that you will use nonces. Okay. So in other words, there is some form of authentication also going on to ensure that you don't have replay attacks and so on. So what happens is, so this is the message exchange. The first message goes to the KDC. So this is R is a nonce in this case. Okay. So Alice generates a nonce, says, I'm Alice, I want to talk to Bob, generate a key. Okay. So what comes back is the nonce. Okay. So this allows Alice to figure out that this key is only valid for the nonce. It's not some random key that was sent to you, because that way, next time you want to communicate with specified different nonce, you can verify that this key is in response to that nonce. Okay. So what comes back is, here is the nonce, this is a key to talk to Bob, here is the key itself. Okay. And then this is basically a message that says, Alice wants to talk to you, here is the key, and this is encrypted with the secret key known to Bob and the KDC. Okay. So this message is basically what you're supposed to send back to Bob after you get this. Okay. So now Alice gets this message, it's encrypted with her session key and the KDC session key. Okay. So you can verify that this message was sent in response to the previous request, because the nonce has come back that you are supposed to use this key to talk to Bob, and this is the key itself. Okay. So you keep these three things, and this fourth thing is actually sent out. Okay. So this is, this part of the message is sent back to Bob, but now you generate a second nonce which you encrypt with the session key, okay, to prevent replay attack. So now this is going to reach Bob. Bob can get these contents because you know the key here. So you know that Alice is supposed, wants to talk to you. This is the session key to use. Okay. And now once you get the session key, you can decrypt this message, because this is signed with the encryption key. So you get the nonce out of the second the first message. Okay. Then you send nonce minus one with your own nonce signed with the session key. Okay. So the nonce minus one allows you to prove to Alice that you actually got the first nonce. Okay. And then you send your own nonce. You issue your own challenge to Alice. So now Alice can get decrypt this message and send nonce minus one back. Okay, this is the, so now both Alice and Bob have a key, and they because they use nonces to exchange this key, no replay attacks are possible here. Yes, any questions? So it gives you similar properties, but it's more robust to replay attacks. Yes.
You could send
the same nonce. There is no reason to send nonce minus one, because if nonce is once in a lifetime thing, you could have just sent the nonce. I honestly think there is no reason to not send the nonce instead of nonce minus one. How replay attacks can So it's not replay attacks per se, but to ensure that this is a one-time session key that you cannot use for any subsequent thing. Okay. So if you attach nonce to the session key, this assumes that you cannot use the key, reuse the key. So the key basically expires when the session goes away.
So it's not replay attack in the sense that the encoder could get the key?
Yes, not replay, but reuse of the same key, which can have problems. Any questions here? So now these are all symmetric keys, right? So we still need to figure out excuse me, how to do this, how to exchange a symmetric key without a trusted third party. Okay, so all of this assumed that there was a third entity called a key distribution center that was acting on your behalf and Bob's behalf, or Alice's behalf and Bob's behalf. So if you wanted to get rid of the KDC, but yet you want to exchange a session key, how do you do that? Okay, that's the protocol shown in the next slide. So here there's only Alice and Bob. They want to set up a symmetric key, okay, for communication. So what you do is you will use public key cryptography to enable to decide on a symmetric key, and subsequent communication will just use the symmetric key, not public and private keys. Okay, that's the basic idea. So what happens in, there's only three messages. So Alice sends a message to Bob saying, I'm Alice, here's a nonce. Okay? And then you sign it with Bob's public key and send it off to Bob. Okay? Since you've signed it with Bob's public key, only Bob can decrypt this message. Okay? So in particular, the nonce will only be known to Bob, no one else. Because only Bob can decrypt the message. Anyone can send the message to Bob, but only Bob can decrypt the message. So Bob will decrypt this message with his private key. So he'll know that Alice wants to talk to him, and he gets a nonce. Okay? So he sends the nonce back. He sends a new nonce, and he also generates an arbitrary symmetric key and sends it. And this, all these three entities are signed with Alice's public key, which is already known to Bob, because it's public key. So now when Alice gets the message, you note that this message came in response to your nonce, because the nonce is in the signed message. Okay? And there's a new nonce there as well as a symmetric key. Okay? So now Alice can take the symmetric key, take the nonce, and encrypt the nonce with the symmetric key and send it back. So this tells Bob that Alice has received your symmetric key, because the third message came with the symmetric, was signed with the symmetric key. Also that Alice has received your nonce, so there is no other replay attacks or anything happening, because the nonce has come back to you. Okay? Reuse, not replay in this case. Is this clear? Okay, so that's a good question. Why do you want symmetric keys? As I mentioned, using public and private keys is very expensive to use. Okay, so you use public and private key, which is higher grade encryption, to decide on a symmetric key for communication, and then you fall back to a more efficient way of communication. Okay, so good example is, if you know SSL and HTTPS, they use 128-bit encryption. Okay, symmetric keys are about 2048 bits. Okay, so like so you can use much higher grade encryption to choose a 128-bit key. So that ensures that this key won't be known to anyone else, because you are using much higher grade encryption technique to exchange the key. Once you use it, then once you get the key, then you can use that key to exchange information securely. Okay, is this clear? Why you wouldn't? That's a good point. I mean, you could have just used the public and private key to send messages. But that's assumed to be expensive, which is why you use it to pick a different key. Okay. So what this is basically saying is, I've already mentioned this last time, saying public key cryptography is vulnerable to man-in-the-middle attack. So even the previous case, you assumed that you knew Bob's public key. Right? So if you didn't know how to get it in a secure way, you are in trouble. Right? So how do you do that? You can again use a trusted server to get a key. Okay, so now what would happen is, let's assume that the trusted server's public key is well known to everyone. Yeah, this, how do you get that? Let's assume that you publish it in the New York Times or something like that. So here is the public key. So everyone knows it, and then you basically know how to communicate with the public, the trusted server, using the public key. So in this case, what you would do basically is ask the public, the trusted server, saying, can you send me, I'm Alice, can you send me Bob's public key? And you can send this encrypted message with the public key of the trusted server. So no one else can read this message. So no one else even knows whose public key you are asking. Okay, so they cannot send you something in that's bogus. And then the trusted server has a repository of everyone's public keys. That's what is assumed. So the trusted server can get the right public key, encrypt it, and send it back. And if it's encrypted with the trusted server's key, only you know that the trusted server has signed the message, and no one else could have signed it. Okay, is this clear? So this is how you can do retrievals of public keys without any man-in-the-middle attack. Now, typically, what happens is, there is no, you don't do this every time. Okay? Instead of the trusted server giving out a key, what happens is, the trusted server just signs your key and gives it to you, your public key. So you just present that public key to someone. And if you trust that server, you know that that key has been signed by someone, the trusted entity. So you believe that that is Bob's key. Okay, is this clear what I just said? And this is referred to as a certificate. Okay, so is this protocol clear what I just said? So in this case, there's a trusted server that is involved in communication. So you ask the trusted server to give you Bob's public key. Okay? Trusted server is a database of everyone's public key. Trusted server gets Bob's public key and then encrypts it with the trusted server's private key and gives it to you. So now you can verify that this message came from the trusted server, because it only the trusted server knows that private key. So you decrypt it and the message has the right public key. Now what I was saying is, rather, this requires the trusted server to be in the communication path always. Okay? One way to get around this is to actually get that signed message from the trusted server and just present it yourself. Okay? This is referred to as a certificate. So what a certificate is basically an identity with a public key. So basically my certificate would look like, so this is the message, and this is signed by okay. So the certificate is essentially your name and your public key, okay, both of which are encrypted with the trusted server's private key. So now I can present this certificate to anyone. And they can verify that this is indeed my public key, because the trusted server has signed it. Is this clear? So you cannot. So in other words, Trudy cannot send Trudy's key claiming it to be mine, because Trudy will not have this certificate. Okay. The only way Trudy could have done that is if she obtains a message that has my name with Trudy's public key. Okay, if Trudy can get a message like this, then Trudy can impersonate me and present her public key. And then so people will then communicate with Trudy thinking they're communicating with me. Okay? But Trudy cannot get this, because it's assumed that there is a way for me to get the certificate without someone else getting the same certificate. Okay? So in this case, what would happen is, if Alice wants to communicate with Bob, you just send a message to Bob, send me your certificate. Okay, and certificate itself encodes the public key. So Bob sends back the certificate, okay, and you can verify that it is Bob's public key, not someone else's public key, because it is signed by the trusted server. Okay. Is this clear or not? Any questions here? So last time I was showing certificates, I had showed you an example of a real certificate which was signed by a trusted entity, because in that case it was signed by VeriSign. Okay, that's a trusted third party. So VeriSign can issue this certificate. You basically have to pay them. You have to prove that your identity, and they'll issue a certificate in your name. You can then show that certificate to anyone, and then they'll believe that that's the right public key to talk to you. Yeah, that no one else can do the same thing. Is that clear? Okay. So the last technique I'm going to talk about does not involve any encryption. Okay, you still choose a symmetric key, but no encryption is being used. Neither key distribution center, nor is there any public or private keys being used. You're simply using properties of prime numbers, and that you cannot factor very large integers very efficiently to do this. So basic problem is, how do you use choose a key without encryption? This is referred to as a Diffie-Hellman key exchange. Okay, so for this key exchange, what you have to essentially do is basically pick two large integers n and g and agree upon them, and anyone can agree upon them. Mean that those could be known to everyone. Okay, so what would happen then is. If Alice wants to communicate with Bob, Alice picks some large integer, that's her secret. Bob also, so let's call that X. Okay? Bob also picks some large integer which is secret to Bob, and only Bob knows it. This. Okay? So Alice is then going to send a message saying, here is N, here is G. This is going in plain text. Okay, and then g to the power x mod n is sent. Okay, so you take your secret and you take g to the power your secret and you send mod. This is a third integer that's sent in the message. Okay, now these the important thing here is just by looking at g to the power x mod n, you are not able to guess x. Okay, by any brute force technique. That's the property you're using. Okay, because you have chosen these n and g to be sufficiently large that you cannot factor them. Okay, as a result, you cannot figure out what x is. If I just tell you g to the power x mod n is, let's say, 100, that doesn't tell you exactly what x you have picked to get that value. Okay. So now what Bob does is that he takes his secret. Okay. So this is the integer that came. Okay. You take your secret and then you send raise that to the power y, which is effectively g to the power x y mod n. Okay. And you basically just send this value back. Okay. And that is what is picked as the session key for the entire protocol. Okay. So the basic thing to keep in mind, what has happened here is you are not using encryption. But you are using basically properties of large integers, namely that you cannot factor them. Okay? And then you are exchanging a key without revealing your own secrets. Okay? In this case, neither x nor y is known to the other entity, yet you have picked the key. Okay? And the key. So that's the basic idea. Okay. So I think there's one more thing I want to mention, and then we'll start looking at applications like firewall and secure email and so on. Okay, the third property that I'll just talk about this briefly is one of access control. Okay, so we looked at sort of two broad properties. One is encryption, which we talked about last time. Okay, and then we looked at authentication, and within the context of authentication, we looked at message digests and digital signatures. And the third property we wanted was access control. The fourth one was auditing, which we are not going to talk about. Okay, we mentioned these four things last time, so auditing we won't talk. But access control I did want to mention. Okay, the access control is the problem of ensuring that when you access some resource, okay, that you have access rights for that resource. Okay, this is independent of authentication. Authentication is just proving to someone that you are such and such. Okay, now subsequent to that, you may want to perform some operation. Do you have access rights to perform that operation? So this is as simple as you do authentication when you SSH into a machine, but when you try to read a file, the machine still needs to check that you have access to that file. Okay, if you don't have read access to that file, you are not going to be allowed. Okay? So that's the problem of access control. So there are two broad ways to enforce access control. One is called access control list, and the other one is capabilities. And those are actually shown in those two pictures there. Okay. So this is the client, this is the server, and the client is trying to access some object on the server. Okay. So you basically send a request saying I want to access or I want to perform some operation R, okay, on that object. So in the first case, in the access control list, there is a list that is maintained for all users, and it tells you who has what rights to on that object. Okay. So it may say Prashant can read and write to this object. Okay, someone else can only read this object. Some other person may be able to write but not read. Okay, you can specify arbitrary access privileges which are maintained in what's called access control list. Yes, go ahead. Yes. So this list is maintained for every object. Okay. Now there are many ways to compactly represent access control. Okay. So if you have thousands of users on a machine, yeah, the size of this list can be very large. Okay. So there are many ways to say. So if let's say of the 1,000 users, 999 users have full access, only one user does not have access. Rather than keeping a list that's 900 and has 999 entries, saying all of these users have access, you can specify a deny list saying only this person does not have access, which is the same thing. Okay. So there are many ways to represent this, but at the end of the day, what the access control list is, it's a long list which specifies of all the users who has access, or who has what type of access on this object, is maintained for every object. Okay. A very simplified version of this is used in Unix file systems which for every file you have this read, write, execute bits for the user group and word. Okay, so there, that's not an access control list on a per user basis. It's an access control list for the user, the creator of the object, or the owner of the object, for the group that the owner belongs to, and everyone else. Okay, there are only three classes there. So it's not fine-grained access control. This can allow you to specify arbitrary access control. Okay, saying only these 5 users can do this, and those 10 users can do something else. So you can have arbitrary things specified using what are called ACLs, or access control list. Is that clear? So the next way to do the same thing, specific sort of check access control, is what is called a capability. Okay, basically think of a capability as a data structure, an unforgeable data structure that basically specifies your access rights. Okay, so now what happens is when you present your request to the server saying I want to perform here is object O, I want to perform this operation R on this object, you specify a capability. Capability is like a certificate that you present saying I have the rights to do the following. Okay. So now the server is going to check your capability saying do you have privileges to access this object? Okay. And if so, you are allowed to access this object. Okay. Is this clear? Or not clear? Not clear. Okay. So let me try to give an example. Okay, so let's suppose we are doing physical access control. There's a security guard who's sitting at the front of this building. And whenever you want to enter the building, you have to the security guard is going to check whether you have rights to enter or not. Okay. So the first, the notion of access control is that the security guard has a list of all the users who are allowed to enter this building. Okay. So when you arrive, you say, I am Prashant, and then the security guard is going to check, are you on this list or not? If you are on the list, you enter, otherwise you are not allowed to enter. Okay. Now in the second case, there is no such list that the security guard is going to maintain. Okay. So what you have to do instead is when you arrive, you show a certificate. The certificate says, let's say the certificate is issued by the dean of the college. Then the certificate says Prashant can enter this building. So I just show up with the certificate and I say here is a certificate that shows I can enter this building. The security guard is just going to read the certificate and say yes, it says you can do this, go ahead. Okay. Now the important thing is to ensure that this capability or this certificate cannot be forged. Okay, that's why it's an unforgeable data structure that specifies your access rights, and you can present and prove to the system that you can perform this operation. No, capabilities could be an arbitrary certificate that specifies all sorts of privileges. It's not on a per object basis, capabilities on a per user basis. Okay, access control lists are on a per object basis. Okay, so that's the difference. Is that clear?
That means if you have this capability that has been certified,
yes,
you can do everything listed in this certificate.
Yes. So it basically capability specifies your rights. This could be arbitrary rights. So for any operation, you present the capability to the system. The system checks whether you have the right to do that operation by checking the capability of the certificate. That's the basic idea. And that's a per user. So here, in the first case, it's per sort of, it's per object. There, it's per user. Any questions on this? Yes. Is there a time? So capabilities can expire, so can certificate. So most of them will have an expiration date on them.
It seems like if you don't have that after a while.
Yes. So not only do you have expiration times, there are ways to revoke it also. There are things called certificate revocation list, because if for whatever reason, so suppose I have this certificate that shows I can enter the building. Okay, but so then suppose I decide to leave UMass. Now my rights have to be taken away, but I own the certificate, so I shouldn't be able to show up later and say I can still enter the building. Okay, so there you have this thing called a certificate revocation list, where you say, is this a valid certificate? If it's in the list of invalid certificate, I will not allow you. So there are things like that. So you can take away rights just as you can hand them out. Any questions? Yes.
Access control is, it seems, gives attaches properties to objects, but while this capability attaches properties to the user.
Yes.
Is there a performance benefit, or why was it done? I think one and both.
So they are one. So I don't. You cannot say one is more powerful. They both do the same thing. One is object centric. The other one is user centric. So if in this case the capability could have a long list of files you are allowed to access. Okay. So and in this case for each object you could have a long list of users allowed to access the file. It just depends on which of the two is more appropriate for that particular scenario. Is that the capability-based thing is more effective for your access control, or a ACL-based thing is more? We're both doing the same thing. One groups all your access rights by object, the other one groups it by user. And so this user can access these files, or these files can be accessed by these users. They say the same thing in the end. So if you put all the capabilities together and all the ACLs together and compute their union, you should get the same thing. Okay, because the rights have to be the same in the end. Any other questions? So typically in the systems that you see, you probably see mostly ACL type access control as opposed to capability. But there are many systems that have been designed and there have been papers written on it that are capability based also. Okay? Yes? So we have looked at ways to sign things, right? So basically, you could have a trusted entity signing that certificate. So then you cannot forge it because you can verify that that was. So you could compute, let's say you have a list that you show up. You compute a hash of that list and that's signed by a third party that you trust. So if you now tamper with this list, you can verify that you have tampered with it. That's simple things like that. You could have hashes that are signed. Any other questions here? Okay. So now that's all the background. We'll now look at actually ways to design interesting things with all of these things. So first one is firewalls. Okay, so what firewalls do is basically they are, this is a machine or a box that sits between two networks. Okay, and it basically checks every packet that goes from network one to network two and vice versa. Okay, and decides which packet gets to go through and which packet does not get to go through. So essentially for every packet or every connection, you check whether this connection can send packets in the other direction, whether it has enough privileges to do this. And there are, so here is what a firewall looks like on the inside. So here, the firewall is sitting between, could be two arbitrary networks, but let's call it the inside network and the outside network. The outside network typically is the internet. So firewalls typically sit between the boundary of the internet and your internal LAN. Their job is to typically protect the machines on the inside. But just as well, firewalls can also prevent users from going out if you don't want them to have that privilege. Okay, so you can do sort of checks in either direction and packet tries to go out or come in. Okay, but most of the time it's the other way when it's coming in. So the way it basically works is there are inside a firewall, there are packet filters. Okay, so what you do is you specify rules that are also referred to as filter. So the packet has to go through the filter. Okay, if the filter catches it, it can drop the packet. So filter specify rules on what is allowed and what is not allowed. Okay. And then there's an application level gateway, so you can do application level rules as well. So you could have arbitrary rules, like you are only going to accept connections. So when an arbitrary packet shows up, you could have a rule that says, drop any packet that comes in unless the connection was initiated from the inside. This is a default rule on all firewalls. Right? So if you have, let's say, a cable modem or a wireless gateway, okay, it has an inbuilt firewall. And the default rules are if you initiated the connection from the inside, then any packet that comes back on that connection is let in. If somebody is trying to initiate a connection from the outside, typically that's not allowed. So you cannot enter the network. You can exit the network. I mean, you can send packets out, and then any incoming packets on that same connection will be let. Okay. But you could have arbitrary rules which say, I have a machine here, okay, allow all packets that are being sent to this machine to come in. So, or any combination of rules can be specified. Now I mentioned the application level gateway part, and this also allows you to have other rules, right? So you could have logs at this level, saying I can log all email traffic that's going back and forth. Okay? You could put your spam filter here, okay? Or you could put a virus checker here, right? Once every packet, let's say a packet is being let in, but you want to check if it contains a virus, you'll actually send it off to the application gateway. The application gateway can look for any virus signatures in the packet and only then let it in. Or it could be an email spam gateway, where you, if the packet is actually SMTP traffic, only then you send the packet to that gateway. The gateway is then going to check if there is this message is spam. Okay? And if so, it can drop it right at the firewall, does not even let it in. So you can do all sorts of things with the application gateway. You could also generate simple log, saying these are all the connections that were established and so on. So firewall is one example where, now I didn't mention a lot of the interesting things that are used here. So you use encryption and so on in the context of firewall, but I'm not going to talk about that in that much detail here. Instead, let me talk about secure email. So this is a mechanism to send a secure message to someone, and we want these properties. We want secrecy, which means whatever is in my message is not going to be known to anyone else. Only the recipient should be able to read what's in the message. Okay, that's secrecy. There should be sender authentication. So it says that when the destination or the recipient receives his message, he or she can verify that I sent the message and not someone else masquerading as me. There should be message integrity. It basically says that I should be able to figure out if someone has tampered with the message. Okay, so if the message comes, I can tell if this message has been altered in transit. Okay. And receiver authentication, which says the receiver has to authenticate themselves in order to even read the message. Okay, so I receive an email, unless I am who I claim to be, I shouldn't be able to read it. Okay. So you want all of these properties. Now how do you go about them? So let's look at each one at a time. And then we will put it all together. Yeah. So secrecy can be used, assured with encryption. We already know this. Okay. So you can assume public key cryptography to send a message. Okay. Now, as you already said, if you take an arbitrary size message and you encrypt it with that person's public key, it is going to be computationally inefficient. Okay. So typically what is done is you actually use symmetric key. So you will generate a symmetric key for the purposes of this message. Okay, you will encrypt the entire message with that symmetric key, and the symmetric key itself is encrypted with the person's public key. Okay, so only that person can then extract that symmetric key, because only they are the private key. That's what is shown in this picture. Alice generates a symmetric key K, encrypt the message M with K, encrypt the key itself with Bob's public key. Okay, and then now what you send is the encrypted message, the one that was encrypted with the key K, and the key itself that is encrypted with Bob's public key. So only Bob can extract the key, because only Bob has the private key. So if only Bob can extract the key, only Bob can read this message. Okay, this ensures secrecy, that no one else can read the message other than Bob. Because there's, Now we'll talk about authentication and integrity. Okay, but no secrecy for now. So we want to ensure that you can authenticate that you send the message, and you want to ensure the integrity of the message. So this is simply done with message digest. Okay. So for the message M, you will compute a hash. This could be MD5. Okay, so you get a hash H for the message M. So then you create a digital signature for that message. Okay. You take the hash of the message and you sign it with your private key. Okay? So now what you do is you send the message and you send your digital signature to Bob. Okay, so what does this tell Bob? So you send a message M, and here the message is going unencrypted. It's going in clear text, because we are not doing secrecy right now. We are just doing authentication and integrity. So you send the message. You send the hash of the message signed with your private key. which is a digital signature. Yes. Exactly. So this tells you that you sent the message because you signed it. You signed the hash of the message in particular. Okay, so anyone can verify that you signed it. Because your public key is known, you can compute the hash and verify that you signed the hash. Okay. You can also verify that the message was not altered because you signed hash of M. So if the message is altered and you receive M prime, the hash of M prime is not going to match what you signed, what was signed by Alice. So you can verify easily that the message integrity was broken in this case. Okay. So now in the first scenario I showed how to do secrecy, and here we showed authentication and integrity. So you could put it all together and you will get everything. So that's what is actually shown here. Okay. So you get a message M, you compute its hash, you sign the hash with your private key. Okay. That gives you a message M prime, which is the combination of hash and the signature. Then what you do is you compute a symmetric key, K, and you compute now the encrypt K of M prime, and then you encrypt the key itself. Wait, I think there's a mistake here. So this should be M, not hash of M. Hash of M is already in there. Okay. So M prime is the message with your signature. This is M prime. Okay. So that is M prime. And then you compute a secret symmetric key and you encrypt the whole thing. You encrypt the original message as well as your signature. That gives, and then you take the key itself and you put it in a sort of, you know, encrypted with Bob's public key. Okay. So then what is sent is the encrypted version of the message and the key. Okay. So I can now get the key out, decrypt this message. Okay. That gives me M and the signature, and then I can verify that you signed the message and it wasn't altered. So that is how secure email works. Because if you want to say, if you have a client, mail client that actually does secure email, this is exactly what it would do. Any questions? Is this clear? What we just said? Okay. So very quickly, I'm going to talk about secure socket layer, and then defer the rest of the discussion to next class. So, secure socket layers, if you know what they are also referred to as SSL. They are used as a protocol, secure protocol between a browser and a web server. Okay. So, if your web server is showing HTTPS instead of HTTP, that shows that the web server has established a secure connection with the web server. Okay, the web browser has established a secure connection with the server. Okay, now what is actually happening underneath is what we want to understand. Okay, now this is useful for secure, if you have HTTPS secure mail access, web mail access, or for secure transactions over the web. So let me show you what exactly happens here. Okay, so this is the message exchange that has to happen in order to set up a SSL connection. Okay, so which is shown to you by HTTPS. So the browser is first going to send a message to the server saying this is the version of SSL I support. Okay, typically now you are at SSL 2 or above. Okay, but there was SSL version 1. So you have to first tell the server what type of SSL you support. So let's assume you send that. The server then sends a message to the browser saying this is the SSL version I support, and it sends some preferences. But most importantly, it sends a certificate. Okay. Certificate is exactly this. Okay, it is basically the name of the server. Okay, let's say it is www.cs.umass.edu and the machine's public key, which is signed by a trusted third party. Okay, so the server presents its certificate to you. Okay, now since the CA stands for the certification authority or the trusted third party, so if the browser has a built-in list of trusted third parties. So if you use Firefox, for example, you go into the Firefox preferences and you look at the security tab, it will show you all of the trusted third parties that are built in. Okay, so any one of those trusted third parties can sign that certificate, and the browser will automatically know how to decrypt that certificate and verify it. Okay, so it will use a list of certification authorities and the built-in public key to verify that's a signed certificate, and it will extract the public key from there. Okay? And then it is going to generate a session key. Okay? And it will encrypt the session key with the public key of the server that just came to you in the certificate. Okay? And then you send a message saying all future messages will be encrypted. Okay? And here is a key. And then that the server will then acknowledging all future messages are going to be encrypted, and it will basically send back actually that's a nonce there. You'll get back the nonce. Okay, and then the SSL sort of session is going to begin at that point. Is this clear? You just send a nonce, which is encrypted with the session key, again to prevent replay attacks. This is just a string. Just saying, I'm going to now start encrypting. So this was all going in plain text, right? So here is where you say, okay, we'll switch over to an encrypted connection. Here is a nonce. Okay, you say, fine. Here is, I agree. And then it begins from that point on. Okay. So just to understand this a little better, you can actually go and get your own certificate from a variety of places. Okay. So if you want to get an email certificate, you go to you can always generate what's called a self-signed certificate. Okay, using all these PGP and so on. So this allows you to generate your public key, but you sign it. Now, whether other people will trust you is a different issue. Right? So this always refer to a self-signed key. But if you want a certificate that someone else, a trusted entity, has signed, then you can always do that. In most cases, it costs money. Okay? But to get email certificates is free. So if you want to embed an email certificate in this certificate into your email client to send secure messages, you can go to one of these many vendors that issue free certificates, and there are many. One is Thought, T-H-A-W-T-E. You can just go there, fill out a form, and they'll create a certificate and give it to you. Then you embed that in your mail client, and then you can use that to either sign your email or encrypt, send encrypted email. So this is something that you can do as a simple exercise. The other thing you should do is actually go into something like Firefox and see what certification authorities are in there and what your Firefox browser will actually recognize. You may have actually started secure connections, and sometimes your Firefox browser puts up a message saying, I got the certificate, I don't know whether to trust it. Okay, then it says don't trust or trust for this session. This is where a certificate was sent which was not signed by one of the certification authority is already built into the browser. So it just shows you the certificate saying, I don't know what to do with this. It's not in my, it's not signed by entities I trust. Do you want me to use this? Okay, so you can say yes or no, depending on what you're trying to do. And then that certificate will be accepted or not. Okay? So let's stop here for today. There's a little more material I'll talk about next time, and then we'll move on to the next chapter.